I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to introduce the speaker. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Father Terry.
Hello, my name is Terry and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober tonight. Grateful to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to be at a meeting where I get to meet some people I've known for a long time. It's always reassuring to see people that you know right away are really bad alcoholics. And then the number of people who raise their hands, it's a vital meeting. Welcome everybody who's the first year, newcomers in first year. I feel very much at home then. In fact, the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place in the world that I eventually feel at home in. Even in an AA meeting, I don't feel at home. It's like, you know, you got to test it out. You got to make sure that everybody isn't too well. If you've got some people in need. And this meeting doesn't look didn't look too well. Anyway, I start what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I started out with the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know I had it. I'm convinced I had it before I drank. But I started out discussing it. Reacting to my father. I grew up in Hawthorne over here, near the LA airport, and my dad was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1944. And his dad came over the week the Post article came out in 1941 and brought the magazine over to his son and said, "Son, find these people." There's a real legacy of periodic crazy person alcoholism in my family, both sides. My mother has three brothers who are alcoholic, and so I grew up with, you know, the first serious discussion I remember around the kitchen table is the disease concept, and I listened. I thought about that. He said it's an allergy, and if you have this thing, the first drink gets you drunk. And I thought, it's interesting that I watch it and demonstrate it. Especially on my Uncle Bill, who'd be just this real nice guy and have one drink and he's gone. And they even got to the deeper stuff where we're defenseless against the first drink. That was a one to think about when you're around seven or eight. My father had a slip and got back in the program and had a slip and he died in withdrawal when I was 6.5 years old. So I knew what my daddy died of. Everyone said it, alcoholism. He was, and so I grew up that way, thinking a lot about it. I went to the seminary and decided to be a priest. I was pretty young, and before that I took a pledge not to drink till I was 21. That's what Catholic kids did often at confirmation time when you were 12 or 13. And the bishop came to town and he would, after the confirmation ceremony, he would say, "Everybody stand up who was going to take the pledge not to drink till you're 21. And it took a very courageous kid not to stand up. I stood up and everybody told me, "Don't worry, nobody keeps the pledge. Have a drink." And I was stubborn and I kept the pledge. And I went through, so I had this good boy early life. I mean, I was in the seminary studying Latin, diagramming sentences, not drinking, playing football and handball and baseball, and thinking about alcoholism. I know in college the longest paper I wrote was called Alcoholism. And I read the big book and a half dozen other books on alcoholism 2 years before I had a drink. And I share that because it's true. And if there's a point to it, I suppose it's that if you get a real good education and you're surrounded by people with a good attitude, that it won't do you any good. If you have the ism and you drink, you know, if you have the ism and you drink, it doesn't really matter how much you know or what kind of an attitude you got. Chemistry wins, and it's a mind twister. And now that I got my little laugh, I want to say that I'm not cynical about education. I think it's a good idea to have education in alcoholism. And it's not that it won't make anybody not be an alcoholic, who's going to be one if they drink. But I think the good it does is that it's harder to get a denial system that's sturdy enough to last until death. You know, if you know a little too much, there's little things give way and you're going to lose your innocence and you realize you're nuts and that there's a problem. And I think that's why I got self-conscious, you know, really early. Anyway, I was going along in my journey and I turned 21 and that was the day it was all right to drink. And on that day I went to the store and bought a bottle of bourbon, sweet vermouth, maraschino cherries, bitters. I mean, I was going to start out right. And I got a recipe book, got a U.S. News and World Report. They used to have these little ads. Southern Comfort had ads with giving recipes for drinks. And I mixed up, and I was very scrupulous. I did it right. I did the math right and got everything right proportion. And I have no words to express how deeply impressed I was by my first couple of Manhattans. I crossed the invisible line sometime in the early afternoon. I had no lag time between beginning to drink and reacting like an alcoholic, reacting as an obsessive. When can I do this next time? How much is there left? Where is that? Where's the thing? My tummy warmed up, my chest loosened up. You know, I didn't know my chest was tight. My IQ went up about 20 points, and I became deeply convinced anything I'd say would be interesting. And that's just the right day one, first hour. I'm impressed. An alcohol high impresses me more than anything in the world. I'm embarrassed that it impresses me more than anything in the world. I felt kind of crazy right away that it impressed me more than anything in the whole world. I thought, you shouldn't like it this much. That was kind of in my head. And I started doing things that I didn't notice I was doing right away. Now, the thing I started doing right away that I didn't notice I was doing was lying. I think if you're an alcoholic, you lie. Now, I didn't think, oh, gee, I'm lying. I didn't think I was lying. I didn't think about it. I just lied. I tried to hide what I really felt about it. I just knew that I wasn't supposed to go, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. No, don't do that. Be cool. And so I would always try to hide from you how excited I was that I was going to get a drink. And I hid from you how much I liked the drink I had. And I tried my best to hide from you how high I got when I had a few fast ones. Non-alcoholics don't hide that. They just start acting drunk. Right as soon as they start getting drunk, they act that way. And we know better than that. We know that if you can still stand up and take a step and say, another one, please, you get a drink, you know. If you just sit there and go, blah, 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 they don't give you another drink. And I would try hard, you know, to mask what I was really feeling, extra control. I would try hard not to look as bad as I really felt the next day. I would never admit that I had this drinking plan. I would never admit that I had drinking plan B ready in case something happened where you could go get a drink someplace else. I mean, I thought, whenever I drank, drinking was on my mind. Whenever I drank, that's what I was doing. And I did other things at the same time. In fact, I was supposed to do other things mainly and then just you know, at a party, I noticed the difference between us and them. You know, I know those other people, they were at the party and they happened to be having a drink. I was drinking and I happened to be at the party. And it's just a different priority, you know, a different thing, my relationship to this thing. And even to kind of, this kind of went through my head some years ago, I shared right off, and just this scenario, I did try to think of what it would have been like if I had ever told the truth while drinking. No, I never did, but I think this would have, is what it would have been like if I ever had. This is, this isn't a fest, this is Tuesday night. But if, let's say on Saturday night, and if I was invited over to your house and there was going to be booze there, and I didn't have a better offer, I'd say, yeah, I'll be over. And if I were going to be honest, I'd show up and knock on your door. You'd answer the door, and I'd say, hi. I'd like to lay my cards. Thanks for asking me over, by the way. And I'd like to lay my cards on the table and get a few things straight before we start out tonight. I'm here to drink. And I'd like a drink. I'd like a double scotch right now. No, not after we talk. Now. Can you give me a double scotch? Look, you were nice enough to ask me over. I'm going to cooperate. You got games to play? I'll play the games. You got other people coming over? I'll try to mix it up and keep this thing, you know, rolling along. Just don't get between me and the bar. And we're going to get along all right tonight. And I usually do pretty well on this kind of a night. I usually don't get too, you know, out of order. But sometimes I go crazy. And, you know, I might get in a fight or throw up on the rug or try to seduce somebody or something. But that's the chance you take when you ask me over. That's the way it is, right? I mean, and I don't think you told the truth either, did you? No. That's the way it was to begin with, and that's the way it was to end with. And I went along through my student years, drinking when I could, and I always drank alcoholically because I'm alcoholic. That's the only way I can drink. I can drink real moderately at times if I don't get enough, or if I'm just determined to be good. You know, and I used to make resolutions to be good, and the reaction to the resolution was opposite to what you'd expect. When I would make the resolution and break the resolution and just drink way too much anyway, I'd say, well, at least you tried. Not too bad. You know, but when I made a resolution to be good and not drink more than one drink an hour and just be, not get, and I was able to do that a good number of times. And I felt terrible when I was able to keep my resolution. Because it was way too much work and no fun, you know. And it just was, I wondered, why am I doing this? I don't want to drink like they drink. I'm not interested in drinking if you have to do it that way. I want to fly. I drink in order to have the thing happen, not to sit there and monitor and be careful and go crazy because I'm not getting enough to drink. So early on, I began to identify with this alcoholic thing, the stuff I'd read about, because I know I didn't have much, and I had that feeling inside whenever I was trying to control my drinking, when I was trying hard to control my drinking, I knew I was going to lose interest in this project. You know, this is getting old fast. I don't think I can keep up my interest in this moderation trip, because it's way too much work and no fun. Well, I thought I had a choice, though. And some, you know, in the early part of our drinking, we have a little more of a choice than we have in the later part of our drinking. And I had a little choice sometimes, and then sometimes I didn't. I didn't have had nothing, you know. I had two kinds of drinking. One is the kind I was describing, the kind where you keep track of things, you know. Kind of be careful. Now, you can die while you're trying to keep track of things. You're going to have head-on collisions. You can fall through holes in the street. You know, the bad things can happen. Just because you're trying doesn't mean you're going to make it. But at least that's a morale thing. I used to, well, at least I'm trying. You know, I'd say, And sometimes I'd, you know, black out while I was trying and wind up in a lot of trouble. But there was other times when I would just lose interest in trying. It was almost like this little voice said, it's all right, do whatever you want. All bets are off. You're free. And I've kind of come to it. I think, gee, usually I care when I'm supposed to get up tomorrow. I wonder why I don't care tonight. You know? And I wouldn't necessarily get terribly drunk when that happened. Sometimes it would. But it was, that's, you know, there's no question about being an alcoholic then. When you go to the really fly, and I don't care. And I know when there were some negative feelings I had drinking very early. And there's two of them I like to mention. And I didn't tease these out and kind of put a name on them until I was sober for quite a while. One of the first negative feeling was right whenever I start drinking, I had this little cloud over the back of, floating back here, a little dark cloud. And it took me a long time to kind of just sense what that was. But whenever I drank and started getting high, I knew that I was going to have to come down. I don't like the idea of coming down. I don't want to come down. I like to get high and a little higher and a little higher and break into out of the clouds into the sunlight and see the face of the living God. That's all. Yeah. I don't want to come down. And I knew that, you know, we know as soon as we start getting there that, you know, they're going to close the bar, it's going to get late, I'm going to get tired, and I'm going to have to come down. And it's just depressing to come down. I don't want to come down. And you can't very well say to somebody, hey, you're looking a little, you know, you look a little troubled. What's the matter? You can't say, well, I'm kind of depressed and bummed out because I'd like to stay loaded forever. And I know they're going to close the bar. And it depresses me. You know, but it's true. You know? And the other negative thing was this, it's connected with that mode of drinking where you just fly when it's, I don't care, lose interest in keeping track of things. And when that happened, there would be this feeling inside of impending death. You know, we talk about a sense of impending doom that alcoholics have. You know why we have a sense of impending doom? Because doom is impending. When you drink the way I drink, the message is something registers in your bones. Like my body knows what's happening. And the message is, you're a dead man. you drink like that, it's over. You know, if you don't care what side of the double line you're on, you're going to cross the double line. You know? If you don't care when you're supposed to get up, you won't get up. You might get up tomorrow, but you won't get up. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. And if you don't care, you know, it's over. You know, it's down the tubes. And something, I think most alcoholics, we know in our bones that we're going away from life, right in the middle of so-called having a good time, when there's not even big trouble yet. You know? That's my opinion. And I was ordained a priest, and I live and work as a priest in Los Angeles right now. I was introduced as Father Terry. I usually think that it's... I think I should acknowledge what I do and what my vocation is, but I don't have to be called Father. That's fine, you did that, but I get a little nervous when they say Colonel or General or Doctor. I'm another alcoholic, right? I've been asked, you know, what is special about being a priest alcoholic? What's special is it's usually harder for a priest to catch on that he's not special. If you're a priest, you've got to do every single thing anyone does in the program if you're going to keep your heart open to the gift of sobriety from the higher power that we all have. It's just absolutely the same. There's no head start. I think atheists and priests are all on the same starting line. and everyone, you know. And I just, you know, was an alcoholic, was trying to control my drinking, and then wondering what to do. And so I went through this trying phase, and while I was doing that, I'd get real tired and real discouraged because it would get out of hand. And then that went on for a few years. I kept giving up drinking, and I gave it up for almost 6 months one time without telling anybody I was going to give it up, without going to AA, without any counseling. I just stopped. And in about 5 months, it occurred to me that I had the talent to quit. I mean, did I quit or not? If you quit for over 5 months, it means you have the talent to quit. And if you have the talent to quit, you might as well start. Because if there's any trouble, you just quit fast, you know, and then nip it in the bud and you'll be all right. That was the thinking. If that made any sense to you, you're in the right place tonight. And I resumed drinking, and and I was in this thing of erratic drinking. I wound up drinking after this quitting. I quit that 6 months, and then I quit a lot after that. I quit so much that I didn't even know. If you asked me if I wanted to drink, I'd say, just a minute, did I quit today? I'd have to think it over, you know. And I say, if it was good scotch, oh, I hope I didn't quit, you know, until I got it straight. And that was so mixed. I was so punchy from quitting so much that I decided that I got to quit quitting. Now, in a way, we quit quitting when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did it the non-spiritual way. I quit quitting because I thought it was making me too nervous. If you quit drinking for life more than 10 times a month, it affects your self-esteem. and so I thought my self-esteem was suffering. So if I just quit quitting and just kind of smooth it out and accept myself as a drinking man, I'll probably do better. So I did that, smoothed it out, and I began to drink about a fifth of scotch a day as this young, skinny priest in South Central Los Angeles. That I would usually have one day a week I did not drink, and I'd get drunk on one day, and I didn't get to pick the day. I would just get struck drunk. It'd be Tuesday morning, Sunday afternoon, I never knew when it'd be. But I just lose track, you know. And that was hard. It's hard work, a fifth a day. You know, by the way, a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place in the world that you can mention drinking a fifth a day and have nobody bat an eye in the room. We know that that's about half as much as two-fifths a day, you know. It is not that it's so much by our standards. In fact, with drinking a fifth a day, I had the feeling that I hardly ever got a drink. You know, that takes discipline. I've never done anything that is as challenging or difficult as a function while drinking a fifth of scotch a day. That's an old-fashioned term, too, now. It's 750 milliliters is the rough equivalent. The old days, it was one-fifth of a gallon, five in the... Anyway, I just... You know, to keep that going, it's less than a quart. To keep that for the whole day, you got to be careful. Have discipline, you know. Don't do it too fast, you know. Measure it out, space it out. Don't do it, you know. So I only got to drink about one out of five times I needed one, you know. And I had a sense of deprivation all the time, you know. Deprivation and like fasting all the time. I needed a lot more than I was getting. Drinking at that rate, they say it's way too much and not nearly enough. You know, I had a feeling I didn't get enough, but man, it's just dead time inside. Just die inside. Everything becomes artificial, nothing spontaneous. I can't listen. Drinking at that rate, I can't. I die in this. I like to describe this, and I don't know if I get across when I try to describe this, but I'll try. This is my description of being dead from alcohol. You know, to be alive, you've got to breathe in and breathe out. A little pond is alive only if a stream's going in and a stream's going out. If there's no stream coming in and out, it just kind of turns icky and is not alive. To have fresh life. And I stayed alive physically. I'm here right now. But when I drink, I go dead emotionally and spiritually. What happens is that when I'm drinking, I can't tell the truth. I already mentioned lying. But I can't speak my heart. I can't say what I got to say. It's all top secret material. You got to be careful who you say it to. And then I'm not even sure what it is. And then when you find, you know, and you just know when once you get near the truth, you have the feeling that it's probably not a good idea to say it. Because someone asked you, hey, how you doing? You're looking kind of peaked. How you feeling? And if you give an accurate report, you'd say, well, I feel like a irreversible and inexorable process of disintegration has taken hold. And I'll be dead soon. How you doing? And you just know that's not a good way to start a conversation. So I better say something else, you know. And then you meet a person who is really bright and loving, mature, and has the time. Meet someone like that. You can't tell them the truth either, because if you do, they'll try to help you. And it's a lot harder to get a drink when they're trying to help you than almost any other time. It's hard to explain to a person who's trying to help you that you must be excused a few moments to have a drink to calm down enough to figure out how not to drink. Which was my situation whenever I was... And so I can't tell the truth. I can't tell my truth when I'm drinking. And not only can't I have the stuff go out, I can't have anything come in. I can't let truth in. Now, I'm not saying, I'm not going to listen to you. No, I'm not. No, it's all automatic. And it took me a long time. I was sober for a while, and I had the experience that all of us have who are sober, who talk to people who are under the influence of alcohol or Valium or things like that. And you're talking to this person under the influence, and you notice something. You notice that what you say doesn't seem to count in the conversation. You notice that just nothing seems to register on this person. You know, they're talking away, and you say your thing, and they just plow on like they didn't hear a thing. And I had that, you know, experience a number of times. Before it hit me, that's me. That's me when I drink. When I drink, the drinking experience uses me up. It uses up my life energy. When I'm drinking, all I have left is the energy for the drinking project. You know, I've just got to make the world safer drinking. I got to figure out the supply problem. I got to figure out how to make the right impression. I got to figure out how not to let you know a bunch of things. I have to figure out how to let you know other things. I got to figure out a lot of things, and I'm very busy when I'm drinking. And I can't, when you come up with your problems and your stuff you're going to tell me, I'm all for you. I hope you do all right. But I don't have time right now to actually care about what's happening to you. I'd like to care. I approve of caring. I think it's wonderful when people care. It's just that I'm just a little preoccupied right now with my drinking project. And later for you, okay? You know, this... And everybody knows that. You know, anyone who's around us, they know we can't care.
Please turn it over.
And everybody knows that. You know, anyone who's around us, they know we can't care. You know, and we can cry in our beer and say, how much I love you. And they know it's a bunch of bullshit. Little kids... 3-year-old kids know that. They're not even fooled, you know. Dogs aren't fooled. That's drinking on a good day. It's my kind of drinking on a good day is being dead inside and having the feeling that I don't care whether I live or die. I've never met an alcoholic or a dope fiend yet who was unable to identify with that sentence, I don't care whether I live or die. That's where it gets us, because it's so clear to me now that when I drink, I ask booze to take care of me in the way only God can take care of me. I ask a high to take care of me. And it can't do it. What it does is just, it shuts me down. Shuts me down as a human being for significant operations. I'm not present. I'm not able to do the regular stuff human beings have to do to be alive. We haven't even got to the trouble yet. No. And thank God for trouble, you know? Thank God for getting in enough trouble to get arrested or hospitalized. Without that, we could all just die while we're still all right, you know? What I started to do was miss things in my parish. I started to excuse myself during confessions. I'll be back in a little while. Don't go away. I had the other priest in the parish conducting a big investigation of the altar boys to catch the persons, the kids who were stealing the wine. And I met a lot of people in AA who said, oh, I was an altar boy and I stole the wine. When I was an altar boy, I never stole the wine. I waited until I was a priest and had the key, you know. I remember that one place I was, they had Angelica, 18% alcohol, you know. After the 6:30 mass, I'd wait till the altar boys left. Are they gone yet? You know, take a little chaser. For breakfast. And I didn't, you know, I was so secret, I didn't want to know that. That was so secret. And so I was missing things and acting strange and getting into standard trouble and talking it over with my boss who would, hey, you're drinking too much. And I'd say, yeah, I won't drink anymore. And I'd say that and not drink anymore for a week or so. And then I'd drink more. And we had about four of those showdowns. And then he turned me into the big boss downtown. And I got to go downtown. I lasted about 2 weeks for the cardinal and came in at 8:15 in the morning for the 6:30 mass. One of those things where alcoholics have a sense of timing and good taste. You know, I arrived home walking across the schoolyard with the children who were on the way to school, a little lunch bag, little sweaters, and I'm dragging my sweater on the ground, coming out of a blackout, wondering where the hell I'd been, the little I remembered was not nice. And I said, I guess this is it. And he said, yeah, this is it. So I got to get fired, and then I was on hold a little while, and I was hospitalized, and I got to go to treatment, aversion treatment hospital. This was 1967. Goes back a little bit, closing in on 30 years now, and they didn't have any treatment centers. It's almost like today when they're all closed. It was a while there we had treatment centers. They said if you ever want a job in your line of work again, you'll go to this treatment center and get this conditioned reflex treatment. And I said, okay, you got me fair and square. And about being alcoholic, I had no doubt about that. Of course I'm alcoholic. They said, the first drink gets you drunk. Let me tell you. Fine. You know? So I went through the treatment like a champ. I was very cooperative. And I got out of there, and I just thought, well, this is it. I'll be sober now. That's settled. Everybody knows. The Archbishop knows. My mother knows. They all agree besides knowing. There's no party saying, oh, he's not really that bad. Everybody, oh, he's not drinking now? Oh, wonderful. And I just settled down to a life of propriety and boredom. And I lasted about 4 months after the hospital and was drinking. I had two kinds of obsession. I had the revelation type and the wear down type. The revelation type is a sudden type. You know, it's when you get it all settled that you're alcoholic. To drink is to die. You got it straight. The first drink gets you drunk. It's settled. It's clear. Don't drink. And you get a revelation. You know, in 20 minutes, you're going to have a drink. I say, well, I'll be damned. 20 minutes, huh? Well, okay. And I just fall for it and have a drink in 20 minutes, like an announcement. And that happened a few times. And then I have the wear down type, where I'd feel like having a drink, and I'd say to myself, listen, dummy, you've been to a hospital for alcohol. You're an acute alcoholic diagnosed. Don't drink. So I wouldn't drink. Then after about 3 or 4 weeks, I'd have another feeling. The creeping feeling would come on, and I'd say, look, you're not even good at drinking anymore. You're no good at it. You're a depressed mess the first hour you're drinking. Don't drink. So I wouldn't drink. A few weeks later, I'd feel like having a drink, and I'd give myself a long talk, give myself a long pitch explaining all the reasons why I shouldn't drink, try to remember what the counselor said in the hospital, what I read, and after I got done with my long speech to myself, I'd feel like having a drink. I'd say, anybody who would still want a drink after all I've explained to you, and after all you've been through, is so weird that you're not worth working on, and you might as well have a drink. And I would drink out of humiliation that I wanted to drink. Because I had not been to Alcoholics Anonymous, where I had found out that if you have an obsession to drink, this does not mean you failed in the program or that you're unworthy. It means you qualify for the program. It means, oh, this is a sign you've got the disease. You didn't make a mistake after all. You should be hugged at every meeting you go to. I know the people get this dread and obsession. I was sober for a couple. I just to fast forward here a little bit. You know, running out of time. I should get sober before we're done here. When I was sober and very active in the program for a year or so. And I hadn't had an obsession for a long time. And I thought I was in the clear. I didn't, if you said, do you think you'll ever get an obsession again? I wasn't thinking about it. I just thought I was in the clear. It wasn't bothering me. And I was going to probably 5 meetings a week at least. And I was at a Tuesday night speaker meeting. I was at the Beacon House, downtown Los Angeles. And someone was going on in their pitch about recipes for drinks. And they gave a number of them. And I gave one tonight myself. I hope it didn't trigger anybody off. Anyway, all of a sudden, I had that obsession. The obsession where it isn't that I wanted a drink. It's that I just found out I was going to have one. You know, it's like this little man walks in the back of your head and says, you're going to drink. If you'd like to give me a bunch of arguments why you should not drink, if you'd like to explain why this is terrible and you'll die if you drink, go right ahead, I got time. But you're going to drink. And you'll save yourself a lot of trouble by having it tonight. Why hang by your fingertips from the windowsill for 3 days and then drop? Because you're going to drop. You know? And while this voice is talking to me, but there's a sense of doom, just doomsday. My stomach just the floor drops out from under me, and I feel completely insecure and being swept out to sea and all of this. And then one little part of my brain saying, oh boy, okay, we get to drink. I have this this little cheerleader for alcohol in my head. Doesn't talk a lot, but when he does, it's very powerful. And as that was going on, I'd been to just enough meetings for the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to come through. And it came through and it said, do not talk to your obsession. You are incompetent to discuss drinking with yourself. Don't talk to yourself about drinking. You're nuts when it comes to drinking. Talk to God. Talk to your sponsor, talk to your dog, talk to anybody. Do not talk to yourself. We're not interested in your opinion on this. And what you have to think and say about drinking or not drinking is irrelevant. That's not going to save you from drinking. It's not going to make you drink. It's just all beside the point. Just shut up and ask God to keep you sober. So I said, okay, God, please keep me sober. And then I thought, well, how can I tell he's helping me? I'm still in the meeting. I can't get a drink yet. I wonder how long I can last. And this AA message came back to me and says, none of your business how long you can last. You turned it over, remember? None of your business. It's not your job. Ask God to keep you sober and be willing to feel like a fool. It's very important to be willing to feel nuts. The program doesn't promise us to feel poised and have it together. At times, we will feel nuts. And we do not have to give a good argument for staying sober. Because if you get a real good argument, you're not impressed with it anyway. We don't stay sober from arguments. We stay sober by the grace of God and just hanging there and just say, keep me sober, even if I don't mean it. No. I know I went from that, after going to that hospital 5 times and being asked never to come back again, I was detoxed in a place in downtown Los Angeles and then went to a recovery house in New Jersey of all priests. And we went to meetings. You had to go to 4 meetings a week, and I went to 8 meetings a week because I liked the guys who were nervous and had to go someplace. And so I started going to meetings, and I was so sure that that AA would not help me that I was relaxed at meetings. You know? And as I started going to meetings, something happened. I began to identify with people. And I didn't know that I didn't say at that time, oh, I'm identifying with people. You know, I didn't use that word. I just felt at home, kind of. I was a nervous wreck. I looked forward to going to meetings. There was life in meetings. And I really looked forward for a meeting to get over. And in this stage of a meeting, you know, when I was a quit at 25 after, and you know that I'm spoke a lot at meetings and I came from downtown, I said, if I were you, I'd be a little worried right now. This guy might talk overtime. And when they talked overtime, I just went berserk. I mean, I just started twisting my chair apart. The deal is until 9:30. You know, I got to get back to my 12-step house and sit there. And then I would look forward to going to a meeting the next day because this is where some life is, you know. And I knew somehow it was on a gut level noticing that, you know, it's funny, I'm just putting this, I didn't think this way at the time, let me tell you, but I'm just observing, I'm thinking about my own experience. And when I identified with people and it gave me hope, it was because I noticed you're a bad alky. I mean, bad. You're bad enough to be dead many times over, but here you are, alive. Okay, you're bad. That's important. And you're not only sober, but you're kind of relieved. I can tell you're relieved that you're sober. You're glad you're sober. That impresses me. And the third thing is that you're still screwed up. I mean, I can see you're not done yet. You know, you got a ways to go. But you're sober. You're glad you're sober. And you're present as a human being. You're saying hello to me. You're saying things to me that encourage me. You are loving me, and you are a channel of God's life, and you're kind of goofy, and I qualify. I'm a bad alky. I'm goofy right now, and so maybe I can be sober and be glad. You know? And then I started to get glad. I was talking to a guy just the other day, well, 2 months ago, in a men's recovery house in Torrance, and I got to share there, and this guy afterwards, a very intense young man with steel circular rim glasses, looking intense, and then he said, I'm just sober because because of fear. I just know if I drink and I use again, I'm just going to die, and I just can't do it, so I just won't do it. But I don't get this program. I don't get the God thing. I don't get anything, and I'm just afraid, and it's just not. I'm wondering, but sometimes I get glad at meetings. He said sometimes he gets glad. And I says, that's it. Anybody who starts getting glad, even if you're just glad once in a while, even if something just rises up in your heart a little bit and you've got to know, and you identify with somebody, you're getting it. You know, you're being drawn in. God is getting you. He's dragging you into the program. And you are finding out that you're one of the brothers and sisters. You're finding out that you're a child of God and you have nothing to be ashamed of at all. You're finding out you're worse than you thought. You're a worse alcoholic. You're more of an egomaniac. You have a dirty mind. And you're afraid of your own shadow. And you're doing fine. And you have the dignity of anyone in the face of the earth, and you're functioning. You're actually connecting with other people and keeping your promises and getting so that you can smell the flowers and not go crazy if you're in line at the market. I know I used to just want to leave with the stuff. I went to just, if I bought, just bought a few things in a drugstore and was in line and someone had a check and then they had a call for the manager, I'll forget it. I'm out of here. I can't wait for that, you know. My friend Larry and I have been going to we go to the same Monday night meeting, the White Flag. Larry goes all year except during football season. If anybody has anything to say to him on the way out, that'll encourage him. Anyway, it's a Monday night meeting. And we had our elder statesman there was John Locke, who died several years ago in his 80s. Absolutely one of my saints in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd say once in a while to us, quit all this trying and join up. the main thing here is to join up. To simply know. It isn't that you got to, just know. The fact is, if you're here and if you've identified with me, it's all over for you. You know? If you identify with me, you're an alcoholic, and you'll never be comfortable anywhere in the world except in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's your home. And everything that's suggested to you and everything that you experience and drawn into that the program causes is profoundly healthy. It drives you sane. You start going sane and doing normal things and getting along with kids better and having more patience with old people, and you're able to stand it sitting alone a while, and everything we do heads towards health, spiritual health mainly, and I'd go into that a little more, except it's time for me to shut up. And I've never seen a group disappointed when somebody stopped. Thank you very much.
Let's have another round of applause for Terry. I've asked Kathy to read a vision for you.
I'm Kathy, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kathy.
A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then.
I want to thank Eddie for reading chapter 3, Roy for chapter 5, and Jeff for the 12 traditions, and I especially want to thank our speaker, Terry, for sharing with us. Thank you all for coming tonight. You are cordially invited to return next week when our speaker will be when our meeting will be led by another sober alcoholic, and our speaker will be Mary O. from Laguna Niguel. And I have asked Darlene to lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
This is recorded August the 6th, 1996, at Arbor Road Speakers Meeting.
This is a Caskey recording.
For copies of this and other tapes, write P.O. Box 15818, Long Beach, California, 90815.